Hello everyone, I'm Kevin Moore and you're now listening to The Moore Show. For the next hour, I'll cover subjects of an alternative variety that most shows do not touch. On today's show, I'm joined by MP Norman Baker to discuss his book, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly. So stay tuned, enjoy, and I'll be right back with Norman Baker.
Missed a show or a guest? Want to know more about The Moore Show and upcoming guests? Then log on to www.themooreshow.co.uk. You're listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm about to be joined with our guest, Norman Baker. Just a bit of background on Norman. He's been an MP for Lewis since 1997, and has a strong reputation for taking up major issues with a forensic skill. In 2006, Norman decided to pursue a quest to establish the truth behind the death of Dr. David Kelly. Kelly, who was an expert in biological warfare, was a former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq. Norman's research into Kelly's death led him to write the book The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly. Well, I'm currently joined here right now with Norman. Norman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Briefly, just tell us a bit about how your book came about.
Well, I was serving at the time for the Lib Dems as an environment spokesman when the events of July 2003 occurred. And I think at the beginning of July 2003, nobody had heard of David Kelly. And at the end of July 2003, almost the whole country had heard of him. And that's because, of course, he had been outed as the source for Andrew Gilligan, who had the famous broadcast on radio about sexing up the government's case for war. And then subsequently he was subject to what some would regard as interrogation by the Foreign Affairs Committee in public. And then, of course, he was found tragically dead on Harrowdown Hill. And that led to quite a degree of political instability. So July 2003 was an extremely busy month. Now, the inquiry was set up by the Prime Minister in record speed to investigate the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly. That got underway, and Lord Hunt began to take evidence. And obviously, as a member of the House of Commons, I took an interest in that matter. It became apparent when Lord Hutton reported in January 2004, two things. First of all, that he had barely considered the issue of David Kelly at all, instead of concentrating on the battle between the BBC and the government, and really Alistair Campbell and the government in many ways, Alistair Campbell and the BBC. And then secondly, that Lord Hutton's judgment on that matter had been completely awry. He concluded that the BBC was guilty of everything, it seems, and the government was guilty of nothing. And I think that was a conclusion people found extraordinary. It led to spontaneous demonstrations at TV Centre when the staff came out to sympathise with Greg Dyke, who had been removed as Director General, and Gavin Davis as Chairman of the BBC. They'd lost their jobs. Andrew Gilligan would lose his job as a journalist. And yet nobody from the government resigned at all. And I thought at that point, if Lord Hutton can get it so wrong on this central political matter, the BBC versus the government, how right was he in David Kelly, particularly considering he'd not given any time to the issue, really, in any depth? There were then several letters appeared in the broadsheets, The Guardian in particular, from medical experts, suggesting that they believed that it was clinically impossible for David Kelly to have died the way that was described by Lord Hutton, and asking for a further process to be followed through, a legal process, namely an inquest. Now, I began to look into those matters, and I have to say, having picked up a few stones to see what was crawling underneath, it was very worrying indeed. I wrote an article for the Mail on Sunday, which was published in, I think, July or August 2004. That led to the biggest response I've ever had from any campaign I've ever done as a Member of Parliament or before, with almost 1,000 responses in terms of emails, telephone calls, letters and so on, mostly letters actually. Some of those offered me new information that apparently Lord Hutton had not had available. Some suggested explanations that Lord Hutton appeared not to have considered. And all of them, bar three, suggested that I should carry on and investigate the matter properly because Lord Hutton clearly had failed to do so. And that's why I then decided to take some time off my party's front bench, take a year off when circumstances would allow, and look into the matter fully. And obviously the result of that was the book I published.
Of course. Now, we're going to come back to the BBC and obviously to the Lord Hutton inquiry. But have you ever had any interest in conspiracy theories before David Kelly then?
Well, I don't like that particular term, dare I say, because that term is used by people to dismiss facts which they regard as inconvenient. It's almost a term of abuse which people use, and by definition it cannot be true. And when they are proved correct, such as the Iran-Contra affair in the United States, they get reclassified as not conspiracy theories but something else. So I try to avoid that, I think, pejorative phrase. But obviously I keep an open mind about life. I don't always believe what governments tell me. I don't believe that those in authority can always be trusted. And indeed, the evidence from the way governments behave, both in this country and elsewhere in the Western world, not to mention dictatorships and so on in other parts of the world, is that they will act for their own advantage, and to some extent, they will not tell their public what they're doing. So I think any sensible citizen, wherever he or she is in the world, will look at matters, not necessarily concluding that a government is corrupt, but not necessarily concluding either that it must be right.
Well, let's go along the words then, independent researcher. Would that suit better?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I've looked at the matter simply in a question of facts.
OK, now, is it true that Dr. David Kelly was the head of the biological defence at the UK government's secretive military research establishment of Porton Down, and possibly was the brain behind much of the West's germ warfare programme?
Well, I'm not sure that's fair to say there's a germ warfare programme. I mean, we have been committed as a country not to an offensive programme, but obviously we have carried out research allegedly for defensive purposes. Now, there's no reason to think that Britain has broken its commitments on that basis. I'm not even sure the United States has, or some would argue it may have done. But what is quite clear is that David Kelly was extremely well connected at Porton Down. He was extremely well respected. He had a tremendous track record in uncovering illegal weapons programs, both in Iraq in the early 1990s and in the Soviet Union / Russia. He was terribly well respected. His security clearance, a copy of which I have, showed he was given top secret access to material, not simply in this country, but in the United States. So he was extremely well respected, very knowledgeable, very important player. And of course, that only underlines how shabby it was for the government, after he'd been found dead, to start briefing that he was some sort of Walter Mitty figure, which is what they did.
Didn't Kelly have proven links to MI5 and MI6? Now, just for the listeners out there, MI6 takes care of security outside the UK and MI5 inside. But what about the links? Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know whether those links are proven or not, but certainly it would be extraordinary if you didn't have contacts with people in MI5 and MI6, whose job it would have been in part to make sure that Britain was safe from a terrorist attack using biological and chemical weapons. So he clearly would have been well connected to the Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, and no doubt would have come across people from MI5 and MI6.
Sure. So he was an expert in WMDs, weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
He travelled to Iraq probably 37 times or more. Did he believe the dictator Saddam Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction?
Insofar as I've been able to establish the answer to that question, he thought there was a possibility that there were some weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and not no doubt partly because of what he'd previously found in the 1990s. But I don't think he was convinced about that. And what he certainly thought, as indeed the evidence suggests that the security services themselves thought, was that the certainty or uncertainty over the presence of weapons was made simplistic by the government for political purposes. In the words of Hans Blix, the chief UN weapons inspector, the British government took question marks and turned them into exclamation marks. In other words, they were given raw material from the security services and the intelligence services to say, you know, this may be happening, we don't know. And they took out the bit saying, we don't know.
Okay, so do you believe then that Kelly was murdered as the British government knew ahead of the 2003 invasion that, you know, Iraq maybe never had the weapons of mass destruction they were citing that they had?
Well, I think it's quite clear, as a matter of fact, that Britain knew that it was unlikely that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And I think it's also, even if they thought he did have some, they would have thought that those weapons were relatively containable. I just refer you to the minute taken by Matthew Rycroft, the Prime Minister's private secretary. This is a minute taken in July 2002, 9 months ahead of the invasion, and which subsequently appeared in the Sunday Times in 2005, just before the election, but actually right on the head of the election, so that people missed it. But this minute is terribly important. It talks about the meeting that Sir Richard Dearlove, then head of MI6, had in America and reported back on that meeting. He's known as C, of course, as the head of MI6 is. C reported on his recent talks in Washington, there was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. And then the response from the Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, to that, again minuted by the Downing Street official in 2002, July, said this, as the Foreign Secretary, "It seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbours, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. We should work up a plan for an ultimatum for Saddam to allow back in the UN weapons inspectors. This would also help with the legal justification for the use of force." So the British government's own assessment in that case in the middle of July 2002 was that the case against him was thin and he was less of a threat than North Korea, Iran, and yet there was no suggestion that those countries were to be attacked.
Wasn't it a rumour as well that David Kelly was on a hit list, you know, from the friends of Saddam and the enemies of Saddam as well?
Well, it's quite clear, having talked to other weapons inspectors, UN weapons inspectors, colleagues of his, having talked to people in his own village, that yes, he did appear to be on a hit list. The weapons inspectors I spoke to told me that it was a normal practice of the Iraqis to try to intimidate weapons inspectors, that they followed them, they knew where they lived, they had information about them, and they let it be known that they were regarded in some way as treacherous to the Iraqi regime. So it's certainly the case that it was a dangerous occupation in terms of antagonizing people like Saddam Hussein. It's also the case that David Kelly told one of the villagers in his Oxfordshire village where he lived that he was on a hit list, and there was a fatwa against him. So it would seem to be the case that there were certainly those out who would have been very happy to see him dead.
Yeah, I mean, if he had been working with MI5 or MI6 and was one of the team members, I mean, why hadn't they protected him? I mean, had he become sort of like a blabbermouth and became maybe a danger to the state?
Well, we don't know. He's definitely working for MI5 and MI6. As I say to you, I think it's clear he had contacts with them, and it would be extraordinary if he hadn't done, but that's not quite the same as saying he was
sure
one of their agents. And we don't know that. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. You have to go back to what actually happened on that fateful time in July 2003 as to what the explanation is for his death, and then try to piece together what might have happened.
Okay. I mean, there was rumours as well that perhaps Kelly was writing a book that would expose Blair and the government of maybe sexing up with information of WMD, and perhaps even a possible black market trade in anthrax. And what do you have to comment about that?
Well, I've no evidence for the latter in terms of the link with anthrax. There are issues about anthrax involving the US administration to answer, but I think that's separate from anything that may have happened to David Kelly or the UK. In terms of the book, I mean, I was certainly aware of that rumour, and I tracked down the publishers whom he'd been in contact with. In fact, I went to see them. They were in a little office in a nondescript part of a shopping parade in Somerton in Oxford, and I went to see them, and they assured me that, yes, David Kelly had been in there to discuss a book, that the discussions had been a very preliminary stage, and he hadn't even sketched a sort of one-page summary, and that was as far as it had got. So, assuming that the publisher was telling me the truth, it would appear to be a very, very limited progress had made on that book, and certainly not enough to justify a motive for him being disposed of.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, amazingly, there has been other, you know, well-known microbiologists linked with germ warfare research in the past sort of decade that have passed on. Could there be any link with Dr. David there?
Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, there is no doubt in my mind that Western governments, or indeed probably all governments, will be prepared to carry out selective assassinations on occasions if it suits them to do so. Now, that may sound like a very dramatic thing to say, but I base my evidence on not least of all my conversations with Wouter Bassen, who you may recall was the head of Project Coast. This is the project established by the apartheid regime in South Africa in the late 1980s in order to specifically design weapons that would kill people and not be detectable. And he told me when I spoke to him, I managed to track him down to Cape Town, he told me when I spoke to him that every Western government has a capability to carry out assassinations, and they all do it on occasions, some more than others. It's also the case that the United States government, for example, under I think it was Bush, but it may even have been Clinton, did expressly give authorization for those who were dangerous to the US to be assassinated. Now, people assumed that would be the odd Islamic terrorist in the field, but the way the legislation was drafted is rather wider than that. And we also know, of course, from US freedom of information legislation, the numerous attempts, for example, to kill Fidel Castro. So I don't think we should be naive about this. I think this is policy of governments to behave in this way. So the idea that there may be assassinations, I think, is one that shouldn't be dismissed.
Yeah, because, I mean, in a final phone call that Kelly made, I mean, you know, in his own words, it was he did express that he wouldn't be surprised if his body was to be found in the woods, and of course that's what happened.
Well, that was actually some time before, rather than the last phone call. That was earlier in the year when he was in contact with David Brauscher, who was a Foreign Office diplomat, but he did actually say that earlier in the year. The other question you asked, which I didn't respond to, was on the other microbiologists. I looked into this insofar as I could, and it's certainly the case that there was an odd conjunction of deaths of people involved in similar work around the same sort of time. This is a chapter of my book called Dead Scientists, when I look into these matters insofar as I can. And now, clearly, I've been able to look into David Kelly's death in some detail, but I haven't been able to look into these other than pick up on media reports. What I can say on that is that some of the people who've been linked appear to have explanations which are quite straightforward. Others, it's more open and more questionable as to how they died, and the explanation that they were disposed of for their knowledge cannot be absolutely rejected. But I want to underline that I've not had a chance to look into this in detail, and therefore I'm not in a position to say whether or not there's any justification for any suggestion of foul play on those particular occasions. But there was a period when those with similar knowledge did end up dead, and there was a similar incident back in 1988, in fact. So that's twice as happened in 20 years.
Do you believe, then, that Dr. David Kelly would have supported the dossier which explained that Iraq could deploy biological weapons within 45 minutes? And was this exaggerated sort of to persuade the British public to go to war?
Oh, I don't think he would have supported that, and I think that's part of the reason why he was talking to Andrew Gilligan at the Charing Cross Hotel. I think it's very clear that those in his department, those in the know, and those in the security services all had significant doubts and were uncomfortable with the way that the intelligence they had provided to the government was being misused by the government, sexed up, in Andrew Gilligan's words, in order to make the case for war. I don't think the intelligence that was being provided was making a case for war. I think the government was making a case. And what's quite clear is that the dossiers, as they were, the various drafts of the dossiers, as they were written, became stronger and stronger and stronger. Less uncertain, more definite about the increasing threat, allegedly, from Saddam Hussein, of which there was no evidence. And what we do have evidence of, however, is the fact that Alistair Campbell was involved in making textual amendments to the dossier, and in all cases bar about one or two, those textual amendments strengthened the case. They took out words like may and inserted words like will. Now, you know, what is a Prime Minister's press secretary doing involving himself in writing intelligence documents? But clearly that's what was happening. And this is quite clear. This was not an attempt. These dossiers were not an attempt to present the position to the British public in an honest way. They were an attempt to, for propaganda purposes, to persuade people to go to war.
I mean, do you buy the idea that Dr. David Kelly was under a lot of pressure? I mean, he was being sidelined and insulted by the government. I mean, a lot of people would believe he just gave up professionally and personally. Just give me a brief outline of some of the forensic and state-of-mind evidence at the time.
You're talking about what may have caused his death?
Yes.
Well, I mean, let me take two aspects. First of all, there's a psychological aspect, if you like, the state of mind, and then there's the physical evidence, the clinical evidence.
Sure.
In terms of the state of mind, the standard version of events is, as you hinted, that he was terribly depressed. He'd been a quiet person, getting on with his work. He was suddenly a public figure. He was subject to a terrible examination by the Foreign Affairs Committee. He felt his life's work was ruined. He was discredited. He was worried about what else might come out. And 2 days later, he went to kill himself, but he couldn't take the pressure. That is not borne out by the evidence such as there is about his state of mind.
Norman, we're going to take a break, so stay there. We'll be right back.
To connect with the show, email kevin@themoreshow.co.uk. Listening to The Moore Show, and here's your host, Kevin Moore.
Welcome back to the show. I'm currently joined here with our guest, MP Norman Baker, where we've been discussing his book, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly. Well, Norman, just before the break there, I was going to ask you, was it true that an hour before David's body was discovered, that officers from MI5 Technical Assessment Unit were already at David's home, and all documentation for his work and possible book were taken away?
Well, the police, if there was work for the book, I mean, yeah. The police response was I think, reasonably extraordinary, and certainly senior police officers I've spoken to outside Thames Valley Police have been very surprised by the procedure followed by Thames Valley Police on that evening. First of all, when they arrived after Mrs. Kelly called them, the first thing they did was search the house. Now, you might argue that's a logical thing to do, given that he may have fallen down somewhere and had a heart attack or whatever. Even so, one would have thought that Mrs. Kelly would have done that herself. But letting that aside, they then went out. There wasn't very much of an attempt to find him, it seems to me, during the night. There were very few officers deployed to do that. The military base down the road was not asked to help with the search. They could have pulled out hundreds of soldiers to help with the search and didn't do so. So that's all a bit odd. The helicopter, which was allegedly used, the times and origin of the helicopter given to the Hutton inquiry, that's now turned out to be false, because I asked questions to the Ministry of Defence afterwards and proved that the information given was wrong. A journalist submitted a Freedom of Information request to the base where the helicopter is, and the information there confirmed the Minister of Defence answered to me, thereby confirming that the Hutton inquiry information was wrong. And what that shows is that the helicopter, first of all, flew only when dark and put down as soon as it was light and didn't carry on the search when it was light. A curious response in itself. Secondly, it shows that the helicopter was equipped with heat-seeking equipment, and actually flew over the spot where David Kelly's body was found without apparently identifying it was there, unless, of course, it wasn't there. And thirdly, of course, the times given, as I say, were wrong at the Hutton inquiry. One has to ask why. So that was rather odd in itself. The police, in the meantime, apart from having this helicopter search, had done very little, it seems to me. And indeed, when they next came back to Mrs. Hutton's, Mrs. Kelly's house in the middle of the night, what they did then was search the house again and ask her to stand in the garden in the middle of the night while they did so. They put a dog through the house and they removed computer equipment, as you say. Now, that seems to me not to be about looking for David Kelly. That seems to be about something else entirely. And one would have thought that they would have been more concerned with finding David Kelly rather than ransacking his house. Unless, of course, they already knew he was dead and were looking to take evidence away.
Wasn't it true that David's dentist had had a break-in and David's records were removed?
Well, that's perfectly true. There was a break-in at his dentist's when his records were removed. Interestingly, the dentist rather thoughtfully had wanted to ensure that there was no card sent to Mrs. Kelly saying your husband's due for an appointment or whatever it happened to be, which would have been difficult for her, and therefore went to find the records to find only that they were gone. And yet, when the next search was undertaken for the records, they were back in the normal place. Now, you might say, well, perhaps you mislaid them, but that seems to me to be unlikely, because the dentist is adamant that a thorough search was undertaken on the first occasion, not least because of the sensitivity of the issue. So it does seem clear that the records were removed and then replaced.
Well, what about the issue where there was no fingerprints found on the actual penknife that Dr. David Kelly used to apparently kill himself with?
No, and this goes to the heart of the inadequacies of the Hutton inquiry, because that particular piece of information was discovered not by Lord Hutton, but by me, through a Freedom of Information request subsequent to the Hutton inquiry to Thames Valley Police. So it's extraordinarily useless inquiry that fails to even ask Boy's own questions of the police. Yes, you're quite right. There were no fingerprints on the knife. There was blood on the knife, but no fingerprints. And David Kelly wasn't wearing gloves, so I'm not quite clear how we're expected to think he caused an incision to his left wrist without leaving fingerprints on the knife, particularly when he had to cut through nerves and tendons with a rather blunt knife. One would have thought he'd have to grip it quite hard.
Yeah, but the actual cut to his wrist, nor the amount of drugs he took, was actually enough to kill him. On top of that, where was all the blood from the cut wrist?
Well, the drugs weren't enough to kill him, as a matter of fact. I mean, the official forensic toxicologist at the Hutton inquiry, Alex Allen, and again, this is in public session, indicated that there was less than one tablet of coproximol in his stomach. And at the very most, a third of the lethal dose, which would have been sufficient to kill him, despite the fact that 29 coproximol tablets were missing. There were three blister packs found in his jacket. 29 tablets are missing, one was left there. So we were invited to conclude that he'd swallowed 29. Clearly he hadn't. Otherwise, the response from the forensic toxicologist wouldn't be as it was. So therefore we have to conclude that those blister packs were planted deliberately in order to create an impression, which they duly did. Incidentally, I should also add that the blister packs were found in his waxed jacket, and the evidence also was he didn't leave the house with a jacket on. And indeed, it would have been rather odd to leave the house with a jacket on in the middle of July in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, wearing a heavy waxed jacket when the temperatures were quite fine. I checked the weather forecast for that day. So, I mean, there were also no fingerprints in the water bottle, by the way, which he's supposed to have used, presumably, to swallow the coproximol tablets. The coproximol tablets are of a long axis. They're quite difficult to swallow, and yet we were led to believe that he swallowed no more than a third to a half of a small water bottle, downing all these tablets, and indeed making up for the loss of blood, because loss of blood will encourage, if there is any loss of blood, will encourage the person to swallow water to compensate for that. And it's also the case, of course, that he had an aversion to swallowing tablets. So there are a number of oddities about this. As far as the incision into his wrist is concerned, that was allegedly into the ulnar artery, not the big artery in the wrist, the radial artery, which you might think someone who wanted to kill themselves would try to sever. Even the radial artery, however, studies from the American prison system in the 1990s show, 275 prisoners tried to kill themselves by cutting the radial artery. Only one succeeded. You can make a lot of mess by cutting the radial artery, but you're unlikely to bleed to death. The ulnar artery is even smaller, much smaller than the radial artery, so it's even more remote, the prospect of dying in that way. And indeed, when I asked the national statistician, Karen Dunnell, in 2000, in three, how many people had died from killing the ulnar artery that year. In the whole of the UK, the answer was one, presumably Dr. Kelly. So it seems an extraordinarily unlikely situation that he died in that particular way. And as you say, there was also no blood. And if you were to bleed to death, you would have to lose a huge amount of blood. The heart would still be pumping. And what would happen then is you create a fountain of blood coming out of wherever the wound was as the heart continued to pump and it found an opening. But there was no blood at the scene, worth talking about. The paramedics, when they arrived, had no idea how he was supposed to have died because there was no blood. The only blood visible, in fact, was on his left sleeve, which is consistent with a cut after death when the blood seeps out down the sleeve. There was certainly no blood on his right hand or right sleeve, and had he been cutting into his wrist with a knife, there would have been a fountain of blood spurt out and leave marks on his right hand and right sleeve. There was none there. So I'm afraid the forensic evidence is simply incompatible with the conclusion of a suicide.
So, OK, if it wasn't suicide, if it wasn't natural causes, how would you sum up what killed him?
Well, what I've tried to do in my investigations, and let me say at this stage, I am not a formal process.
Sure.
What I'm campaigning for is a proper inquest, a proper legal process. It's extraordinary there's not been a proper inquest into David Kelly's death. What I've done is raise questions, but insofar as I've looked into it, I'm convinced beyond reasonable doubt for the reasons I've given that he was murdered, because suicide's impossible. It clearly wasn't natural causes. It wasn't an accident. So that only leaves you with murder. I then decided to look into what might have happened, and for reasons I gave in the book, I think he was killed by people of Iraqi origin. The third question is who commissioned those individuals, and that I'm less certain about.
Okay, but when his body was found as well, just one other thing, I want to go back to the body. I mean, there was apparently two different positions they found him in, two different teams. Do you know much about this?
Yes, I mean, even Lord Hutt admits the body description of where the body was different. Some said he was leaning up against a tree, others he was flat on the ground with his head some distance from the tree. And there appears to have been different descriptions of where his body was, timed to before and after the police were there. So you could make your own conclusions from that. Lord Hutton's conclusion was that this was simply a matter of people remembering incorrectly. And he said of the police in particular that the fact that they all told different stories and their evidence was conflicting demonstrates that they're all telling the truth. Because had they all been lying, they would have concocted the same story and stuck to it. So the fact that they were all over the place, Lord Hutton concluded, showed that they were innocent of anything other than bad memory.
Yes, but also what about the strange operational name that Thames Valley Police gave the inquiry, i.e. Operation Mason? You know, a very strange and apparently prepared an hour before the actual body was found as well.
Yes, well, that's right. It was Operation Mason. I asked the police about why I'd been called that, and they said that there is a sort of alphabetical list of names, and that was the next one up alphabetically after something else, you know, Martlet or something, who knows. So that's their answer for why it was called Mason. It certainly did start at 2:30, half an hour before David Kelly went for a walk. That much is still available for anyone to see on the Hutton website, because we have the front page of the Operation Mason as one of the documents on the website. It's extraordinary how the police were able to start an operation to someone's disappearance before he'd actually disappeared. I did ask the police about that, to explain that, and the explanation I was given was that the operation timing relates to the period of interest for the operation after it started, rather than the time at which it starts. In other words, they were interested in everything from 2:30 onwards. Well, that may be an excuse of some sort, except that the police clearly were interested in matters before 2:30, including all the emails which were sent, including people he'd talked to in the last few weeks and so on. So what appears to be a superficial explanation, which is satisfactory, I'm afraid loses all credibility when it's looked at in any depth at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so his actual body is found near his home in 2003. Then, I guess, a number of days afterwards, he's named as the source for the hugely controversial BBC story.
Yes, well, I mean, there was evidence before that he was a source of that, and that was why he was interviewed by the Foreign Affairs Committee 2 days before his death. But yes, I mean, quite clearly, the events of July 2003 in many ways were extraordinarily volatile, and he was at the centre of them.
But how did the actual BBC behave towards the, you know, David Kettle's death? I mean, you had the Greg Dyke sacking. I mean, what were the BBC's role in all this?
Well, the BBC, I think, had tried to report the matter honestly and accurately, and the report at 6 or 7 on the Today programme, which Alistair Campbell went ballistic about and which caused Andrew Gilligan to lose his job, now seems to have been pretty much accurate. Not much wrong with it now. Alistair Campbell complained it was single-sourced. Ironically, of course, the intelligence on which he based his dossier, the 45 minutes from Doom angle, that was all single-sourced too, but we never heard about that till afterwards. So, you know, there's a bit of double standards here. So the BBC tries to do what it should do, but it was aware, I think, at an early stage that this was a hugely political issue, and they were under tremendous everyday pressure through letters from Alistair Campbell to behave differently. They stood their ground until such time as the Hutton report criticised them, and then they found themselves out in the limb, and then they lost their Director General and their chairman. We then had the most appalling instance I can imagine of the BBC, or imagine or remember, of the BBC vice chairman, Richard Ryder, coming out and making this vomit-inducing apology to the government and saying it would never happen again, of such a nature that even the government were embarrassed by it. And I'm afraid the BBC has not yet recovered from that terrible apology. And we won't know, really, whether the BBC is actually truly independent until another such incident comes along and we see how they deal with it.
So do you think the BBC is a bit more reserved in what they say since the actual Hutton inquiry?
I think the BBC exercises independence of judgment and political independence up to a threshold of, say, 80% or 90%, whatever that threshold is. But when it's really, really hot, the question is the BBC going to stick with it with its backbone, or is it going to crumble? And we don't know the answer to that now. It crumbled last time.
I mean, with all the corruption in the government, the controlled press, where do we go if we can't trust the BBC for our news?
Well, that's a very serious issue, and the reality is that we are seeing less money spent on investigative journalism. The number of newspapers who can spend any time at all on investigative journalism is now down to a handful. You're probably down to the Mail on Sunday, the Sunday Times, the Guardian. That's about it. No one else has got the resources or the money to do that. You know, I spent 9 months of my life on this book, investigating it all. Even with the newspaper with the biggest generosity towards investigative journalism, no reporter would have got more than 3 or 4 weeks on the story. So, you know, you're asking papers to and the media to investigate to a depth which they're simply not equipped to do anymore. The opposition to the BBC in terms of broadcast media is by and large disappearing. ITV's retrenching into game shows and reality TV. Channel 4 still there with dispatches, but that's about it. And the real question is whether or not the media is equipped to deal with this sort of story. It seems not to be.
Yeah, I mean, with the actual Hutton inquiry as well, I mean, this was set up to investigate the death of Dr. David Kelly, but this was a statutory inquiry, so, you know, more than a coroner's inquest, where the witnesses can't be forced to sort of stand or be prosecuted for what they say. I mean, do you think this is right, that this inquiry was led to be this way?
Well, this is the point of this is the point at which the medical experts are still pursuing the government on, namely the absence of a proper process to investigate the death, and I think they're quite right to do so. Yes, this was a non-statutory inquiry. Now, under the Coroner's Act 1988, the government at the time provided a mechanism whereby the coroner's inquest, traditional coroner's inquest, could be replaced by an inquiry. And the reason they did that was perfectly fair and sound. They wanted to ensure that, for example, where there was a train crash and you had 58 people died, then rather than having 58 repetitive inquests when the same information would be given, the evidence are given again and again and again, you could deal with it in one go, which is not only more efficient, less time-consuming, and also less painful for the relatives and family. So there's nothing wrong with the process. But in every occasion since that Act was passed, when this provision has been used, on every occasion it's been used for multiple deaths, except for David Kelly's. It's the only occasion when one death's been investigated in this way. Secondly, on every occasion when a coroner's inquest has been removed, It's been replaced by a statutory inquiry with natural safeguards in law, such as proper cross-examination, people there under oath able to commit perjury and or be prosecuted for perjury if they do so. This is the only occasion when there's been a non-statutory inquiry. So two firsts, single death, non-statutory inquiry. And what that means is that David Kelly's death was investigated to a lower standard than any other violent death in the last 50 years. The most sensational death of the last 10 years investigated to a lower standard than any other death.
I mean, what's your views on this sort of Hudson inquiry being a whitewash? I mean, do you really think it's going any new evidence was brought out into the actual public domain?
Well, no, it was useless. I mean, it was a farcical process. First of all, Lord Hutton spent what time he did spend on looking at the BBC and the government and got that wrong. Very little time on Dr. Kelly. Secondly, he made assumptions which were simply not based on, he abandoned his own legal processes. Let me just quote you what Lord Hutton himself said. He wrote this himself in the Inner Temple Yearbook 2004-2005 about the David Kelly inquiry. At the outset of my inquiry, it appeared to me that a substantial number of the basic facts of the train of events which led to the tragic death of David Kelly were already apparent from reports in the press and other parts of the media. Therefore, I thought that there would be little serious dispute as to the background facts. I thought that unnecessary time could be taken up by cross-examination on matters which are not directly relevant. Unnecessary time on cross-examination. That's how he approached his own inquiry, and he'd read it in the media, so it must be true. You know, is that the sort of process we want? But that's what the kind of process we got. Key witnesses were not called. The police officer in charge of the investigation, for heaven's sake, was not called. Chief Inspector Alan Young, now promoted, of course, superintendent. He wasn't called. He wasn't even mentioned in the Hutton inquiry. My Pedersen, Dr. Kelly's best friend, who knew him intimately through their weapons inspector's work. She was in the U.S. Army, U.S. Widely regarded as a spy in the U.S., she knew him very well indeed. They shared postal addresses in the U.S. He flew one side of the states to the other to see her. These were not passing acquaintances. She knew all about him. She knew, for example, he had an aversion to swallowing tablets. She knew, for example, he damaged his right elbow shortly before his death so badly he was unable to cut steak in a restaurant, let alone cut his own wrist. And yet, when Thames Valley Police were asked by Lord Hutton, to talk to Mike Pedersen, they came back and told Lord Hutton she had nothing of relevance to say.
Incredible. I mean, with Lord Hutton, I mean, who was he? I mean, why was he brought in to head this inquiry?
Well, I think Lord Hutton's an honest man. I have no reason to think he's anything other than that. But there's an episode of Yes Minister where the minister, Jim Hacker, says, can we get a judge we can lean on? And Sir Humphrey says, we don't lean on judges, Minister. You choose a judge who doesn't have to be leant on. And I think that's the key here. Lord Hutton, in his honourable and honest way, I think, had a record of being very antagonistic towards the media and of generally being on the side of the government of the day, whoever the government were. So he was a safe pair of hands, a safe choice to come up with the right answers. But even with Lord Hutton appeared to look into matters by asking Thames Valley Police to speak to Mike Pedersen, you know, he was misled.
I mean, even after Kelly died, his name was still being smeared with spin and manipulation of intelligence. Is there any sense of change in Westminster nowadays since the Hutton inquiry? I mean, are things being done differently?
Well, I'm not entirely hopeful. The Chilcot inquiry is underway, of course, and that's being a bit more robust than the Hutton inquiry was. It's also non-statutory, and therefore no one's there under oath. But I have spoken to Sir John Chilcot, and I think he acknowledges that Lord Hutton's inquiry didn't do Lord Hutton's reputation very much good. And I think he wants to make sure he's not someone to fall into the same trap. So I think he'll be rather more robust on sorting out the politics of 2003. We'll wait and see what he concludes from that. But that's only the political aspect, of course. It doesn't deal with the death of David Kelly. Will that be looked into further? Well, I don't have much confidence, to be honest with you, unless matters begin to unravel further, because clearly the present government has no wish to do that. The Conservative opposition voted with them in favour of the war, and therefore it's not a happy period for them either. But we'll see. There are MPs in all three parties who are unhappy with the conclusion that David Kelly committed suicide. A number of them have gone public, including Patrick Mercer, for example, on the Conservative benches. Even more have told me privately they think I'm right. So it depends. We are beginning to see matters unravel slowly, so if they continue to unravel, we may get there yet. Yeah.
So you do believe, you know, obviously that the Dr. David Kelly issue should be reopened?
Absolutely. I mean, irrespective of what people think about what happened to him, everybody in this country is entitled to a proper legal process. And when you have a violent and unexplained death, the proper process is a statutory coroner's inquiry. We've not had that. In fact, the coroner's inquiry was started in this case, and it was discontinued by the government, who told the Oxford coroner to get off the case. So I'm also unhappy with the position where government ministers tell coroners to stop their work, but that's what happened in this case. So there are so many loose ends. There is so much conflicting evidence. There's a good deal of clinical evidence that suggests it's impossible for him to have committed suicide. He cannot be left like this.
I mean, is there any websites that people can get in contact with you with, or is there any sort of websites where they can show support?
Well, they can certainly contact me on my own website, which is www.normanbaker.org.uk. They can write to the Attorney General and suggest that she should apply to the High Court for the inquest to be reopened.
Norman, we're at the end of the show now, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
To find out more about Norman Baker, go to www.normanbaker.org. Well, from myself and my guests, until next time, thanks for listening.